it's your girl Karina here, and I want to take a minute to thank our partners that make the Big Silence podcast possible, plus our programs at the Big Silence Foundation. So I know you've heard me talk about one of my favorite go-to wellness tools, hot and cold therapy. I've always sought out ways to enhance both physical and mental well-being, and today I want to introduce you to MyHigh Cold Plunge and Chiller and the Gravity Infrared Sauna Blanket, both which I use a few days a week. So they work wonders for your physical well-being, from boosting circulation, promoting muscle recovery, to reducing inflammation, and even improving sleep quality, which is amazing. Bonus, they're affordable and portable. And you know, I'm always on the go. So as someone who has lived with anxiety in the past, I firsthand know how crucial it is to find healthy coping mechanisms. So the Gravity Infrared Sauna Blanket and MyHigh Cold Plunge are the ones. Portable, easy to set up, and you don't have to fill it with bags of ice. It makes it very, very simple. So in 5 minutes, I have my sanctuary anywhere I need it so I can let go of stress and embrace my inner powers of peace. Whether you are a seasoned wellness warrior or just dipping your toes into the world of self-care, the MyHigh Cold Plunge and Chiller paired with the Gravity Infrared Blanket are a perfect pairing to care for your body and your mind. So bundle up and join me on a greater mental and physical wellness journey and get your blanket and plunge for 25% off. Head on over to thebigsilence.com/partners. And of course, you can find all of these links in the show notes. Enjoy the show.
We can find things to be grateful for about ourselves, like the awareness that we're doing something wrong and we could do better. That is a gratitude moment, not a judgment moment. Doing intentional breathing, doesn't matter how, really, just direct your attention to your breath and just breathe slowly in and slowly out once in a while and just decide to breathe rather than letting your body do it all the time by itself. And that makes a difference. The addictive behavior is doing something or reaching for something outside of us that is to distract or numb us from those uncomfortable feelings rather than what we're supposed to be doing, which is just sitting with the feelings and feeling them. The ability to bounce back from stress when it comes and be able to keep yourself in balance. That's resilience.
The Big Silence.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Big Silence podcast. It's your BFF Karina here. How are you? I hope you're doing amazing this week. Okay, so I just want to get in to talking about today's guest, Dr. Dave Rabin. He's a MD, PhD, neuroscientist, psychiatrist, Apollo Neuroscience co-founder, and a chief medical officer. So Dr. Dave was in town for South by Southwest, so he got to come here to hang out in the Big Silence studio. And we had such a great conversation. I've been using Apollo, and we'll go into detail on what this device is during the conversation. But I've been using it on my sleep setting. And during South by Southwest, when I left this conversation to go to Snapchat Sanctuary to speak, I had it on my social setting. And I can't even explain. We'll talk about what this Apollo device is in this conversation. But okay, so Dr. Dave Rabin is, like I said, a neuroscientist, board-certified psychiatrist, executive director at the Board of Medicine. He is one of only a handful of psychedelic experts with credentials as an MD and PhD. And he is practicing ketamine, MDMA-assisted therapy, all of that stuff. So it's always an interesting conversation for me to ask all these questions about these new therapies. But we talk about therapy for PTSD and all the things Apollo Neuroscience. So enjoy the show. And of course, share, like, comment, and I will see you on the other side. All right, Dr. David Rabin, welcome to the Big Silence podcast. And welcome to Austin.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Of course. I am currently wearing your Apollo and for a social setting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to need this all day because we're here at South by Southwest. You're in town. We're all buzzing around, being very social.
Yeah.
So have you been to Austin before?
I have a few times.
Okay.
Yeah.
You like it?
I love it.
Yeah.
It's a great city.
Compared to San Francisco, like...
It's similar in terms of the kinds of people that used to be in San Francisco, because a lot of our friends moved here.
Yeah, on the tech side.
but it's a, I mean, it's a great community. You know, live music scene is unreal. So much cool stuff going on.
Yeah, I know. It really is. So you're MD, PhD, neuroscientist, psychiatrist, and Apollo Neuroscience co-founder and chief medical officer. That's a lot.
It's a lot.
Overachiever.
It's fun. So it's how, a lot of overlap.
Yeah, it is. So how did you get there? Those are titles, but how did you get there and that interest in going there?
I've always been interested in consciousness and the way we think about the world. Short story is, when I was a kid, I had intense, vivid dreams growing up. Like many people, you know, between the ages of like 4 and 7, I remember waking up and just feeling like what I experienced during my dream was like, was extremely real. And so over time, I found myself, you know, it wasn't always nightmares, sometimes, you know, fun stuff or just regular conversations with my brothers or friends. But I found myself talking to my brothers or friends and then mentioning something that happened in a dream.
Yeah.
And they didn't remember it. And I was like, oh, that instantly, like that happened in a dream. So then as I got older, I asked my parents, you know, like many kids do, what's going on in these dream things we're having? And they're like, oh, those aren't real. Don't worry about it. Like most parents say. And I just never really sat right with me, because occasionally I would still have them and they'd still feel so real. And so how do you, you know, so I started to question from a very young age, what is real?
Okay. And I mean, I'm 42 now and I'm starting to, I had vivid dreams as a kid too. I wasn't expecting to talk about dreams, but I want to talk about this because it's the question of like, what is real? So you study the brain, and I vivid, reoccurring dreams as a kid, same age as you. And then now I went for years without having dreams I could remember, but now it's very, very vivid. And then I can wake up from a dream, and as soon as I close my eyes again, I'm back there. What is going on in our brain?
It's a really good question. And I don't think we completely understand what's going on in the brain yet with dreams. I think what we do know, and what we've learned over the years, is that dreams are a lot like our very first psychedelic state ever for all humans. And what I mean by that is that when you think about what the word psychedelic really means, psychedelic, psyche means mind, delos means to show or to reveal. So we're really talking about states that aren't necessarily related to drugs. They're states where parts of our minds that we were not necessarily aware of before now come into our awareness and they start to be revealed to us. And so when we enter dream states or other similar states, like deep meditative states, which can be induced by yoga, deep breathing, soothing touch, eye gazing, eye contact, right? These deep, powerful meditative states that can be induced naturally actually start to quiet what we call our ego mind, or that part of the mind that's focused on survival and decision-making and protecting ourselves all day. And when that part quiets, also, which is what happens in a dream, all of a sudden all the, you know, the what Freud called the subconscious material, all the stuff under, all the parts of the iceberg underneath the water that you don't see, right? That becomes visible and witnessable. And then our brain starts to be able to process and work with that material to create a more whole or complete understanding of ourselves, which includes transferring memories from short-term into long-term. And that's a whole part of what happens when we dream.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned, so you had dreams as a kid, and let's give it, so you wanted to explore that and learn about the neuroscience of it.
Yeah. And I was fascinated by dreams, the idea of reality, consciousness, you know, what is all this? How do we interpret all the stuff going on if we can't even agree on what real means, right?
Right. And
so then I realized I, you know, really want to study neuroscience. And from a very young age, I started reading a lot of science fiction and neuroscience stuff that I could get that was like at my level. And I started to get, you know, do research opportunities as I got older in high school, you know, working with university researchers, just shadow, do some summer projects, things like that. And that was really fun. And I became really excited by all the different things going on in the field. However, studying consciousness at that time, you know, this is in the early 2000s or, or late 90s, was very challenging. We didn't have a lot of the modern technology we have now. It wasn't widely accessible to look at what's going on inside the brain. And there were not a lot of people who had made successful careers studying consciousness. And psychedelics were not as understood as they were in 2012 when I started to come, you know, finish my PhD in neuroscience, you know, fast forward in medical school. And I was, you know, looking about what was going on in the field. And I, because consciousness was so hard to study, I ended up studying chronic stress for, you know, 10 years, and stress being a major factor that changes how we see the world and impacts our bodies. And some people can cope with stress and become stronger and faster and better, best version of themselves. And other people get shut down by it. And that's a lot of a perspective issue in terms of what we consider real and how we make meaning around stress and what it means about us. And so that was kind of my foray into that area of research. But then 2012 happened and like 10 top tier psychedelic research papers came out around psilocybin and MDMA and all these other things that were happening. And it was showing this tremendous promise to study consciousness using psychedelic drugs that we had never been able to have access to before in clinical neuroscience and psychiatry. And I was like, okay, this is it. This is the time. And I knew that had to be my path.
It's so interesting because in my world, in my peers and people, you know, I hang out with, the psilocybin and MDMA therapy and all of this is fairly new. And coming up a lot more. And I've always been on the fence of it. I have a lot of PTSD growing up with a schizophrenic mother. I misused MDMA and all of the things as a teenager. So I kind of, you know, I'm very wary of that. And like how that now is being legalized. Because is MDMA therapy just being legalized this year?
It should be. It's on the FDA's desk.
Okay.
And that's not, it might not be legalized. This year's a little nuance. It will be FDA cleared this year, which means that doctors will be eligible to use it in their clinics with patients, not to send home.
Okay.
But once that happens, then the technical legalization process happens where it gets rescheduled by the DEA, which takes more time, but will eventually move forward and make it more accessible to everyone in need.
Yeah. So if you're looking, say you have, what would the perfect client be or patient to have that?
When it first comes out, I think it's going to be mostly people who have post-traumatic stress disorder only. And then as it becomes more widespread, and I mean, that's a lot of people. You know, it's estimated that's like at least 20 million people in the US who have PTSD. So that's a lot of people. And that's what the focus is going to be straight out the gate. From there, over time, it will start to be used off-label for other things like depression and probably some anxiety disorders, things like that.
But do you think depression, in your studies, depression is a genetic thing and anxiety, or is it because of how we are raised and the PTSD?
So everything in our whole lives is a combination of our genetics, the code that we were born with, that kind of like sets a template of how our bodies function in the world, and the environment. And the environment shapes the way that our genetics were programmed to adapt effectively. But the adaptation part is a skill and it's trainable. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So when you, the common misconception, this is one of the most common misconceptions about mental health that has actually been debunked over the last couple of years through studies around the world. Major one recently being at University College of London, showing that if you look at over 100,000 people who have been in studies of depression, that there is no significant genetic correlate for depression. There are small groups, like maybe less than 1% or 1% of people who have something that could be considered like a more genetically related depression that's inherited. But it is 99% of people, the most common reason why they wind up with depression is trauma. And so what that means is that there's not actually a neurochemical, for everybody who's been told that this is the case, there's not actually a neurochemical imbalance in your brain that is resulting in your depression. It's the trauma or the unprocessed, unresolved traumatic events of the past that all of us have faced that in some people, if we don't process those events and you know, have the support to get through it, then that seems to be what is likely causing the neurotransmitter imbalance in the brain, which then looks like depression or looks like ADHD or looks like whatever other mental illness. But it's the trauma itself that is not resolved that seems to be the root cause of modern theory of psychiatry. And so that's what we're trying to get back to that's what psychedelic medicines are starting to teach us. Right. And that's what indigenous tribal cultures and uh-huh. Eastern medicine practice have been teaching for thousands of years. So,
and now we're talking about it.
Coming full circle.
Yeah. So, okay. So my mother and my grandfather suffered from mental illness. And generations before that. And there's intergenerational trauma from my grandparents immigrating from the Ukraine in the 50s and all this stuff. But I had this fear that I would become like my mother and my sister. And she's 2 years older than me. But it skipped a generation. So is that... And I've done a lot of work. I was severely, you know, situational depression as a teenager for a decade and drug misuse and all of that. But then I decided to become resilient and do the work. I did EMDR, read a ton of books, meditation, yoga. In my early 20s, I started doing all of those practices. And your experience and with your patients, is that something like a shift in the thoughts?
I mean, you're rewiring your brain by building emotional muscles.
Yeah.
So when you practice resilience practices like that, you're training in different ways, your attention, your gratitude muscle, your presence muscle, just being present in flow, your bounce back muscle, which is like what we call resilience, right? It's the ability to bounce back from stress when it comes and be able to keep yourself in balance and in check. Every time the balance gets tilted one way or the other, you right the ship, right? Mm-hmm. That's resilience. And that's a muscle. It's an emotional muscle. So as you train it, just like you're doing bodybuilding in the gym, you teach yourself over time to be able to adapt to stress and adapt to whatever it is that comes your way much, much quicker and faster so that it doesn't take a long-term toll on us. Mm-hmm. And that actually seems to reliably decrease people's likelihood of developing mental and likely physical illness. And what's so cool is nowadays you can measure it on most wearable trackers, because people, all wearable trackers that are fitness trackers, Oura Ring, Apple Watch, Whoop, and many others, they all track heart rate variability.
The HRV.
And HRV is now coming out as the most reliable, consistent metric that you can get easily through wearables of longevity. Mm-hmm. Health span, so how good and long your life is, your overall resilience and ability to adapt to stress, and how recovered you are. Mm-hmm. And if your HRV is lower than it usually is, chances are you're run down and you're likely to get sick if you push yourself too hard. Mm-hmm. And that's a really useful thing to know when we've never been taught how to understand that for most of us with intuition, right?
Yeah. I know. I used to wear the ring and my HRV. Kept being low. I was like, get off of me. But it is true. Like, that is okay. Slow down, relax, take care of yourself.
Because take it easy today.
Yeah, take it easy today. And that's a good thing. Like, you know, relax. Okay. Without feeling like guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to go back to psychedelics. So PTSD and going back to use a patient as an example of where they come from, doing a treatment and where they end up.
With MDMA assisted therapy specifically.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll give you the kind of the way the trial goes, because that's the MDMA therapy right now is only able to be used in the clinical trials.
Okay.
And the clinical trials have been nothing short of astounding in terms of the results. MDMA assisted therapy is from the phase 2 and phase 3 trials that the FDA has been reviewing to give their seal of approval this year. It has shown the best results, with no overstatement, the best results we've ever seen with any medicine for a mental illness in the history of psychiatry.
Really?
People are with just three... So people come into the trial, either veterans in large part, or people with severe sexual trauma and severe long-term PTSD that has not responded to anything in almost every case. They've tried almost everything. EMDR therapy, multiple medicines. And with just 3 doses of MDMA and 42 hours of psychotherapy with 2 therapists over 12 weeks, so condensed course, 3 doses, 42 hours therapy, 2 therapists, 12 weeks. All right, 12 weeks, not life. Mm-hmm. Pretty good.
That's pretty quick.
Yeah. It's like amount of time, less time you put into an intensive rehab program, mm-hmm. right? Or it's like a surgical rehab type amount of time. So you have this condensed amount of time and they have an 88% response rate in this population. We have like a 30% or 40% response rate with the current drugs that we have available. They have an 88% response rate with MDMA. That means 88% of people are starting to see some improvement.
Okay.
2 months out, 52% of people in the phase 2 trials are no longer meeting diagnostic criteria for PTSD. Wow. They are in remission. Mm-hmm. 1 year out, no additional treatment. That 52% number goes up to 67%. Mm-hmm. People get more better after the treatment is stopped with no additional treatment. Mm-hmm. How is that possible?
Do you think, are there also lifestyle changes that go into that? Obviously going through therapy and talking, talk therapy and talking about what is going on in your life, certain things you get rid of, certain things you need to start doing. So it's the whole program.
It is.
It's not just, yeah.
But what's really interesting about the MDMA therapy protocol, which I'm trained in, is that you don't tell the patient any of those things. Mm. The patient has to figure it out for themselves through a process of MDMA accelerated non-judgmental self-discovery. Mm-hmm. So, and that's that safety state that's so important that for anyone who's wondered how MDMA works, it seems to work by molecularly activating safety cascades in our emotional brains. Just, like a hug does, mm-hmm. right? Get a hug from somebody you like, you hold a pet you like, all of a sudden you get these powerful safety signals that shoot to your emotional brain and says, hey, I'm comfortable, I'm safe. This mm-hmm. feels nice and that's okay, mm-hmm. right? And that just helps us feel safe and comfortable or what we call embodied in our bodies.
What if, I'm just throwing questions out that come in my head. What if someone who, let's talk about ketamine. Do you have much experience with that?
I'm training ketamine therapy. I also work with ketamine with my patients.
Okay. So what if you get someone who's an addict? Let's say specifically ketamine.
Like somebody who is addicted to ketamine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do they do ketamine therapy?
Not typically.
Okay. I don't know. Or somebody who is maybe addicted to a prescription pill.
Right.
And they're trying to heal their addiction. Would they go through a ketamine therapy?
Yes, it depends, right? So my background is addiction and trauma psychiatry.
Okay.
So I work with these folks a lot and not a lot of other people will. Mm-hmm. But I think the challenge, it's very nuanced, right? Because addiction is a very stigmatized word. Mm-hmm. And what addiction really means is that a person has developed a certain pattern of behavior mm-hmm. around numbing or distraction mm-hmm. to discomfort. Mm-hmm. So every time we start feeling comfortable in any way, restlessness, racing thoughts, fidgetiness, anything, anxiety, whatever you want to call it, the addictive behavior is doing something or reaching for something outside of us that is to distract or numb us from those uncomfortable feelings rather than what we're supposed to be doing, which is just sitting with the feelings and feeling them. Mm-hmm. Because humans are feeling machines and we were born to feel stuff. So if we don't feel it, our bodies get really upset and restless because the feelings mm-hmm. get stuck. Mm-hmm. And they want to just be felt so they can leave.
Yeah.
The whole point of a feeling is that it's a signal that you're supposed to feel, right?
Right.
So that's a really common misconception that results in addictive behavior because people don't realize and they're not taught that we're supposed to feel our feelings. We're not supposed to shut them down. It's okay.
It's okay to feel. What would you say? What would you say like the top five feelings that we experience that are normal but we don't think are normal?
Anger. Uh-huh. Sadness.
Okay.
Shame. Mm-hmm. Guilt. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Unworthiness of love. Okay. Like being disconnected.
Yeah.
Because everybody feels disconnected sometimes. Loneliness, uh-huh. right? Like, those are terms that words that we use to describe, like, I'm kind of labeling like subsets of feelings.
Yeah.
But anxiety, right? So many people feel anxious and they feel like there's something wrong with them because they feel anxious.
Maybe that's your body telling you like something's not.
It's your body right. telling you that you should be paying attention to something right
yeah,
now.
Like there's something going on.
Yeah, there's something that needs your attention. That's mm-hmm. how we evolved. Mm-hmm. And that's critical to understand because every single animal has the exact same thing going on. It's mm-hmm. not just humans. We all evolved to tune into whatever it is that's causing our anxiety or anxiety. Anxiety is a signal. It's not good or bad.
Okay, so what if you're having a feeling of loneliness that causes anxiety?
Then, you know, we should feel it, mm-hmm. right? The whole point is feel it first, like all feelings. Step one, feel mm-hmm. the feel, mm-hmm. right? And then when you feel it, usually what happens is you start to go through a whole series of emotions, right? Like when you think about grief because you've lost something, mm-hmm. there's like these five stages of grief, mm-hmm. like the denial and the anger and the sadness and the blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. And those are just common patterns that we go through when we suffer a loss. So the same thing happens to us when we, when we have the kind of situation that you just mentioned, right? We go through these stages of feeling.
I feel lonely, so I have anxiety, but then...
So
feel unworthy.
Right. Well, but think about it. Let's break it down even more, yep. right? So I start to feel feelings of loneliness. I'm going to deny it. I'm going to shut it down. I don't want to feel loneliness. That's too painful. So mm-hmm. it starts with denial. Loneliness is the loss of community. Mm-hmm. So to accept the feeling of loneliness and that might exist for us, which is not necessarily a pleasant feeling, we have to feel comfortable to allow that feeling through. And if we interpret that feeling as meaning that I've lost my community or I've lost connection to others, that's a grief process. Mm-hmm. So we start out actually denying the feeling. Mm-hmm. After we accept the feeling that there is a feeling of loneliness that's trying to get our attention, then what happens is everything you just said, mm-hmm. which is like the anger, the mm-hmm. sadness, mm-hmm. the anger, and all the rest. And so, but the point is, that while all of those things that we just talked about are typically unpleasant for most people as we were taught, if you just go through that process every time you feel lonely, all of a sudden there's an answer and a light at the end of the tunnel, which is, I'm going to go do something that makes me feel less lonely. And then you don't feel as lonely anymore. But yeah. you have to go through the grief process for that feeling.
And allow yourself to feel that.
Exactly.
And I feel, because I have a lot of male friends, and I have a husband, and do you think that there is this, that men feel more loneliness?
It's an interesting question. I think everyone feels really lonely a lot of the time, particularly right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that men in many cases are taught growing up to act in a certain way or do things that are not necessarily in the best interest of the community, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. Like things that are like very self-protecting behaviors.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. Like when you have enough money and you have an opportunity to do something that results in sharing that wealth with the community you live in, mm-hmm. and bettering the community because you don't need it, or giving or doing something that disenfranchises the community to get more money for yourself. Mm-hmm. So many men in these situations will decide to do something that disenfranchises the community to get more money for themselves, which actually doesn't make them happier. It isolates them more from the community, which contributes to their loneliness more. Mm-hmm. But if they understand that their goal is not aligned with their actions, the goal is to be more connected and have more love and affection and community. But then you start to realize, hey, I'm doing things that are misaligned with my goals, mm-hmm. right? But many of us weren't taught how to think that way.
Yeah.
Women, I think, are often taught growing up, for better or for worse, that, and you know, there's more caregiving prioritized, mm-hmm. right? And so... women, and you know, women naturally, like mother, we all come from mothers, right? Mm-hmm. And mothers are like the original caregiver. Mm-hmm. And so there's a certain kind of communality and larger view of that I think many women are taught to, or even to some extent biologically have, that provides a greater sense of, let's make sure we protect the we and mm-hmm. the us. so that we don't wind up with people feeling so alone all the time. But to that point, one of the biggest problems with not dealing with that head on, not like tackling that as a society, because we're still in the denial phase, is that what do people do when they don't have help with that loneliness? They self-medicate with drugs or gambling or video games or sex or work or whatever. And they wind up hurting themselves and their families because they're just not in a position where they feel safe enough to feel those feelings and let them go and accept, right? That they can do things that can change their loneliness that are actually in the best interest of the community rather than just themselves.
Yeah. And then all of those things, the list of things, the gambling, the sex, the addiction, just lead to depression.
And more hurt and more hurting
and other people
and
your family. So do you think, I think it can be so overwhelming sometimes when someone is having those emotions and can't handle it. And like, how do I take that first step? And I have to do all these things. I have to be perfect. But really, I know from my own experience that it's like the little steps that you take. And not overwhelming yourself with, it's not an all or nothing. I think
exactly.
A lot of people are the all or nothing. You go, go, go and do this. And then, okay, now it's like even working out. I know some people who are like, work out every day, you know, very intense. And then it's like burnout. So what are some tips on just taking that first step for your mental health and overcoming any PTSD or feelings of anxiety?
I think the first step is what you just said, which is understanding that, you know, there's no such thing as black and white over 90% of the time. You know, if you for those who don't know anything about statistics, the black extreme and the white extreme, the bipolar ends, those are usually only like 3% of the time. Everything else is like 94% or something of the time.
Yeah.
So that means 3% of the time you're in the white and 3% of the time you're in the black, and 96% of the time, where are you? In the gray.
Yeah.
Right? And the gray is where all the richest of life exists. That's where the opportunity for change comes, which is just making small victories, right?
Yeah.
Doing small little things where you start to say, hey, I noticed that thing that I've been doing for the last couple of decades doesn't actually align with my goals.
Yeah.
It's not getting me to where I want to go. Okay. I can judge myself for it and waste much time doing that. Or I can learn from the lesson and change my behavior and do it differently. Let's try something else, right? Let's try doing something that is aligned with my goals. I was drinking coffee before bed for the last 10 years and I realized that my sleep sucks, right?
Yeah.
And like, let's not do that anymore and see what happens. Simple experiment, right? I know lots of people where that is actually a thing that they never considered and they can't sleep.
Yeah.
Because that was something they grew up learning to do. For school, parents, whatever.
Oh my gosh, I used to drink way too much coffee.
Me too.
Way too much. And now I don't even, I'll have like one sip a day.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that the best steps are, you know, start with understanding, then actually make small changes in your life that make you feel good and that ideally make you feel good and more comfortable and more safe and also like breathing. Doing intentional breathing, just doesn't matter how really, just direct your attention to your breath and just breathe slowly in and slowly out once in a while and just decide to breathe rather than letting your body do it all the time by itself. Yeah. And that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Right? Non-judge, like don't judge yourself so much. Don't be so hard on yourself. We can in any moment replace judgment with self-gratitude.
Yeah.
Right? We can find things to be grateful for about ourselves. Like the awareness that we're doing something wrong and we could do better. That is a gratitude moment, not a judgment moment.
Yeah.
Right. And that's those simple little things that make a difference. And, you know, as I'm saying it, I'm realizing that this is, you know, easier said than done. And it takes a lot of practice. But that's why we developed Apollo also, is to help nudge you along the way.
That's what I want to talk about. I'm wearing Apollo Neuroscience here. Can you talk about that more?
Sure.
Yeah.
So Apollo is a technology. It looks like this little guy. And you can wear it anywhere on your body. And it delivers soothing vibrations to your body that we developed in the lab at the University of Pittsburgh that activate our sense of touch. Just like a loved one giving you a hug or holding a service animal or an animal in general, or, you know, having ocean waves wash over you at the beach. All of these things are core safety feelings to us that make us feel comfortable in our own bodies. And this goes back hundreds of millions of years to, or at least 50 million years, to the very first mammals who started nursing their young. Because a mother nursing a newborn baby, there's no verbal communication there. The baby can't verbalize anything. Everything about conveying safety to that newborn is through sense of touch.
Yeah.
So touch is one of, if not the most powerful safety pathway in the body. And we got tuned into it because MDMA-assisted therapy seems to be molecularly activating safety pathways, as I said earlier. And so we thought, well, maybe if safety is the key that MDMA unlocks for people, what if we could give people more of that without a drug? And so we went back to the lab and started to explore the neural pathways that get activated when we feel safe. And lo and behold, it's the same pathways basically that MDMA activates.
See, I can get down with that. I can get down with the Apollo and not, and, you know, just, I did too much MDMA as a teenager. But
and this is not, just to clarify, is not going to feel like you just took a full dose of MDMA.
Right. No.
But it gives you a lot of the basic safety benefit components that MDMA activates so that, you know, you can get 40% of the way there, which is pretty darn good without taking a drug, and there's no side effects and you can use it anytime you want. Like, so that's a tool now that we can all have in our arsenal for emotional, you know, for like an emotional remote control for your mood and your energy and your sleep and just helping you be more of yourself wherever you are in your flow.
What are the different settings?
So there's a whole bunch of settings or vibes. Each vibe is basically a song that we compose based on neuroscience for your emotional nervous system.
So cool.
So you can wear it anywhere in your body. It is sound waves, basically the same sound waves that come out of your subwoofer, that when you feel that big bass in your body when you're standing at a show or something like that, that for many people can be like a spiritual experience. Yeah. That is the same frequency range that Apollo delivers as bass sound that you wear. And those vibes range from energy, which is like, feels like espresso, to social, which is the one that feels similar to MDMA. It's like a creative social flow state. Focus, which is deep focus flow for intense solo work. Then recover, which feels kind of like 5 minutes of moderate breathing. It's not sleepy or wakeful. And then we get into the really calming, deep meditative sleepy vibes, which are calm, which induces deeper meditative states, feels like a 20-minute deep breathing, then unwind, which kind of feels like a cannabis indica or a glass of whiskey, and then sleep, which I would say feels kind of like Ambien. And if you use, but without any side effects, and if you schedule them in the app, which you can set up automatically or we do it for you, they turn on automatically throughout the day and night to give you energy when you need it and help you sleep when you need it. And it gives you up to 30 minutes more sleep a night, which is really useful.
Wow. I love this. I have one of these, but I told you I left it in Palm Springs. Can I keep this week?
Sure.
This one? And I want to go to the app and test it out and see how I feel this week and then do a little review on it on this pod.
Let's
afterwards.
Do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Happy to.
Yeah. That's cool. I do feel, I mean, I don't know if it's like just because I know I have it on social setting. I'm ready to get out there at South By and like be social for the next few days. But it's
really useful for events.
Yeah.
Really, really useful for events when you're like bouncing from place to place.
And it's, okay, I'm going to keep this on.
It has this really interesting effect. I notice when I'm in busy events and places, that is something that I really, really like that I don't notice as much when I'm solo with it, which is that it like noise cancels my brain. So like, you know how when you're in a public place and there's like a million things going on around you or a bunch of people trying to get your attention, you're bouncing from,
That was me last night.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you put this thing on and you get into your vibe, in the social vibe in particular, and it's like all of a sudden, especially if you're with other people who are on it, you've just entered a vibe bubble.
Oh, shit.
And like you've noise canceled everyone else around you and you're just in it together and your attention is like acute. Like high acuity attention where you're not overwhelmed or distracted by anything else going on around you in that moment. And it is so freaking cool.
Okay. I'm excited to try this on. Yeah, that was literally last night, like me and like trying to focus on one person. And we're both like, what? What?
Yeah.
What?
Right. You know? Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. I have trouble with that too.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the podcast, Dr. Rabin.
My pleasure.
I could keep talking to you, but as you know, we're buzzing around being social. So I appreciate you coming here to the podcast studio. Where can everyone find Apollo and more info from you?
You can find Apollo at apolloneuro.com or wearablehugs.com.
Oh, I like that.
The kids call it. And you can find me at drdave.io, which is my personal website, clinical practice website, and at Dr. David Rabin on Instagram and Twitter. And if you want to check out more about my work with psychedelics and consciousness specifically, we do a deep dive every 2 weeks on the single source of truth of the psychedelic news, which is called the Psychedelic Report on Spotify and Apple Podcast.
Amazing. And we'll put all that in the show notes. Okay, one bonus question from me.
Let's do it.
Okay, so I'm on the social setting and I'm an introvert, but I'm social. So in between, when I'm in an Uber going to the next event, do I shift my setting?
You can. I mean, I would try it and see.
Yeah.
But I think that, I think if you use social, my wife is also an introvert, very well coped introvert, but an introvert nonetheless.
Yeah.
And basically when we say introvert, I think this is also a commonly misunderstood term. It doesn't mean that you don't like people. It means that you usually get drained by being around a lot of people.
Yeah. I get energized. I'm like, oh, I have to go be social. But then I'm there and I love it. But then I have to come back.
But then you just come back and recover, right? Like it takes a lot out of you.
Yeah.
Whereas like true extroverts, which I would probably am one of those, get tons of energy from being around people. You could just do it endlessly.
Yeah.
And so I think the social vibe is by far, hands down, the best vibe for introverts to be in that environment, because it just helps you be like present and in flow and just like, you know, not resisting it as much. And once you drop into those experiences, you start to gain more energy from it so you can sustain it for longer. But then if you feel yourself getting real tired in between when you're going from place to place, recover vibe is the one to switch to. And that just helps the body get into more of like a vagal recovery state. It boosts your HRV even more for a short amount of time, which just helps your body recover more quickly.
Yeah.
And then when you get back into the next setting, next environment, social vibe again, back in, get to it.
All right. Well, let's go be social. Thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today and every Wednesday. If you loved this episode or think a loved one could benefit from listening, please share. And follow us on Facebook and Instagram at the.big.silence. Head over to thebigsilence.com to sign up for our newsletter to stay in the loop for live events coming up and details on the release of my memoir, The Big Silence. And as always, we'd love a like, subscribe, and leave a review on anywhere the podcast can be found. I love you, and I will see you next Wednesday. The Big Silence. The Big Silence.